Hi, everyone. This is Angeline Hartman with a bonus episode of Inside Crime. If you're a true fan of true crime, then you know Josh Mankiewicz of Dateline. He's a dear friend, so he graciously agreed to let me interview him at CrimeCon last year in front of a live audience. Our interview has never been released publicly until now.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to Inside Crime with Josh Mankiewicz, my friend. This is so awesome that you guys showed up here this morning. And I thought you'd be sleeping in. I heard half of you guys at the bar last night at 1 o'clock still being crazy.
Can you guys hear me? Is this mic on? Is this working?
We can hear you.
Okay, good. It's not, right?
I want you to yell.
It's on.
It needs to be higher.
Hi there. That's a little better.
There you go.
Good.
There you go.
Cool. Okay.
How's that? But I hear a little
Well,
something.
It's a little reverb. Okay, maybe that's a little
Okay, maybe
much.
That's a little too much.
Yeah,
yeah that's yeah. what. Okay. How's everybody doing this morning? Good? Yeah. Thank you so much for showing up. You know, Inside Crime is really a baby podcast in the podcast world. If you think about it, this time last year, we didn't have Inside Crime. And so this is the first live interview. This is our first interview. This is our first time at CrimeCon for Inside Crime. And it's our first live interview with Josh. And you are the first live audience, so thank you to everybody.
Most people would not show up for a podcast like this, but you didn't do that, did you?
No.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you'll get your checks later. Back. You know, Josh tells story for a living, obviously, and I said, hey, Josh, I think there's lots of people who really want to know your story.
Or about 50.
Or about 50.
Yeah.
Or you guys.
Yeah.
So you're here to hear Josh's story, and Josh's story begins...
it begins...
you can lie about the years, you can. Doesn't have to be accurate.
One of the things, I made three promises to myself when I started on the air. One was that I was never going to use a blow dryer, because that was at the time, a stereotype of TV reporters, that they all had, you know, sort of this perfect blown dry look. I think that's all sort of based on Geraldo Rivera, who had
Was Geraldo carrying a blow dryer?
Well, he had fabulous hair, anyway.
Okay.
And so he was definitely part of that stereotype. And I also vowed that I was never going to color my hair, which clearly I have not done. and I also vowed that I was never going to lie about my age, which a lot of people in television do. So I'm 63. I started in this business in 1975. When I was in college. I got a summer job at ABC News in the summers, working on the assignment desk in Washington, D.C., which is where I then lived. But I was already very into this business and interested in pursuing this as a career before that.
Why? Because,
well, I grew up sort of in the 1960s, and I watched the space program, the civil rights movement, at Watergate, unfold in front of me, and it was those were the stories that were told, you know, very extensively on television, on TV news. My parents and I, and my then infant brother, watched the CBS Evening News every single night at dinner time without speaking. I mean, literally, we would sit down to dinner, and Walter Cronkite would come on at 7 o'clock Eastern time, and then we'd begin watching the broadcast, and then after the broadcast there would be a discussion led by my father, who'd also been a journalist for a lot of his career, about what we had learned.
But that was normal at that time. Maybe not the discussion,
right.
But you know, across America people would have dinner hour and right at 6 o'clock, that's when you
Right, won. And the other thing to remember is that there were only three networks back then. And so the ratings, the number of people watching the evening news at that hour was like the Friends finale every night.
Right.
Every single night you had this gigantic share of the audience. So the next day, if you said to somebody, you know, hey, did you see that thing about, you know, the kid who's building a rocket in his backyard because he wants to join the space program? Or did you see that thing Nixon said about Watergate, whatever it was? Chances are, people did see it. They were all watching the same television programs you did. Now, if you say, did you see this? No, I didn't, but I'll look it up.
Yeah. I'll go to YouTube. Yeah.
Look who's late to the party.
Look who's late to the party.
Yeah. That's you I'm talking about.
Yeah. The one standing, the lone one that's late to the party.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are the true blue fans,
anyway,
Josh fans here.
So anyway.
On time.
Right. Yeah. Right.
It wasn't a fight.
So anyway, that's the end of my story of my date with Dateline. Anyway, so I was already super into this business back then when I started working there in 1975. I was so stoked when I had that summer job. And I worked in the middle of the night and distributed the newspapers and the assignment sheet. I remember once I picked up Sam Donaldson's suit from the cleaners, which was a... you know, kind of an honor.
Now, what was that job? You were picking Sam Donaldson's suit up from the cleaners. Were you an intern?
No, it was paid.
Paid people were picking up suits.
Oh, yeah, it was called desk assistant. Yeah, all those rules were a little looser back then about what you could and couldn't do. And, I mean, that was you just reminded me of something, which was the words sexual and harassment existed in the dictionary, obviously, in 1975, but they did not exist together. And behavior, when I was at ABC News, behavior that would make everybody fired today was rampant. And it was hair raising. And even though it was my first job, I remember thinking to myself, this cannot be okay with anybody. I mean, it's astonishing that this just goes on and no one says anything. But in many cases, of course, the person you would have complained to would have been the person who was bothering you.
But, so, you know, I will say newsrooms are different environments than any other work environments.
They are.
Anyway.
They absolutely are. I mean, they are. Although, in the eyes of employment law, now they're not.
Now.
But certainly, if you don't, you know, if you want to make sure that you are never yelled at or cursed at or made fun of, then you probably should not work in a newsroom regardless of what happens after that. Because they can be kind of...
And very intense.
Yes, and places where ideas are shared freely. But this was way beyond that. This was not something that would be a gray area today. It wasn't. But it was a tremendous education, and then I worked there in the summers until I graduated from college, and then I went right back there. And I had a huge, I got really lucky two times. One was that I went to ABC News right after college at exactly the time that Rune Arledge, who'd been president of ABC Sports, took over ABC News, and he made this huge expansion of ABC News. So all these jobs suddenly became available, and you know, people used to be like desk assistants for like 4, 5, 6 years before they could get promoted. Now people are getting promoted like every couple of months.
Right.
So that was, I benefited from that, and I ended up on Capitol Hill behind the camera sort of covering Congress, which was fascinating. And then I worked there for a while, and then Carl Bernstein, nobody remembers this, Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein took over the ABC News Washington Bureau, at which he was spectacularly miscast, because that's a management job, not a reporter's job. But one of the few things that Carl did while he was there was, and I'd never met him before, was decide that I should be on the air. And so he called.
So it was his idea, not your idea.
Oh, it was completely his idea. I mean, I wanted to, but
sure.
I mean, it was. I was figuring that I was going to like leave and go to, you know, some small station somewhere, which was what people did then and what people do now, too. And Carl called the guy who ran the affiliate in Washington, D.C., and said, I want you to take this guy for a year and put him on the air. And this was the most famous journalist in the country calling this guy.
Wow.
And he was like completely, I think you might have met him at a party or something. I'm not even sure he, I mean, and Joe Albritton was his name. He's dead now. But the station bore his name, Joel Albritton. I went to WJLA, which was the ABC affiliate in D.C., which was the eighth largest market in the country at the time, which is where you don't start. the advantage I had was that I'd lived in D.C. for a long time, and so I completely knew my way around. And I also knew, you know, from reading the paper, I knew, like, which city councilman didn't like the mayor, you know, and what the history of the police department was. And so that definitely helped, because I'd lived there for a long time. But then they put me on the air, and then a year later, I went back to ABC News as a correspondent. I was 26. And they put me in Miami, although mostly my furniture was in Miami. I was somewhere else. And I spent a lot of time in Central America, and I spent a lot of time in the Mideast. I did a lot of war duty back then.
And still no blow dryer?
I did not have a blow dryer, okay. No. I also didn't have any of the things that people have now when they cover wars, like bulletproof vests or security with them. They really just sent us into the countries and sort of crossed their fingers. And in 1979, before I became a correspondent, an ABC correspondent named Bill Stewart, who did not speak Spanish, was shot to death in Nicaragua, executed by government troops. And still, even like several years after that, we were still all of us going into battle with essentially no protection except our wits. I remember going to I was in the Mideast in summer of 82 during the siege of Beirut, and I brought $100,000 in cash in a brown paper bag from our base in Israel to Beirut. I had to drive up the coast, and of course you go through a couple of checkpoints during which there's these kind of like not tremendously friendly militia guys who don't really have any allegiance to anybody except themselves, and they stick their heads in the car and say, "What are you doing?" And I'm thinking, like, you want $100,000, like, it's there. I'm not going to stop you, you know? And then you're going to shoot me anyway. So, but they somehow, I guess they must have thought it was my lunch or something. They never asked for the money. They didn't ask about the bag I had with me. And they'd want to know where we were going. We'd show them our passports, or we'd set TV on the, we'd put TV on the windshield in duct tape. And they would let us go. Those were in the days in which being a journalist sort of, you know, made you an honest broker to both sides, and people weren't afraid to sort of let you go and deal with you as uninvolved.
And were you enjoying it at the time, or were you like waiting for your?
Well, I didn't enjoy. I mean, I learned a lot being an ABC News correspondent, but I hardly ever got on the air. I mean, I was like at the very sort of bottom rung of the networks. I mean, we had a lot of correspondents back then. Mm-hmm. Probably more than 100 correspondents back then. Now there aren't anything close to that, but. So, I mean, like, I never got on the evening news. I was there 4 years, and I got on the evening news under 20 times. And Good Morning America, which I got on a fair amount, that was like the backwater back then. That was not the, now it's the money show. But then it was not. And so if you were sort of thought of as second string, or as I was, like third or fourth string, you got put on in the mornings and on the weekends. I did a lot of radio, which was fun. I was on Nightline a couple of times, but mostly I was sitting on the bench waiting. And so after 4 years, I quit. I went to WCBS in New York with a CBS-owned station where I covered Long Island for a couple of years, which was fun. And then I became the political reporter there, which I did for about 5 years, which was great. Ed Koch was the mayor. Mario Cuomo was the governor. Rudy Giuliani was the prosecutor. He was running for mayor.
So now you're doing local news.
Yeah,
but exclusively
politics in a city that kind of runs on politics. Mm-hmm. That was a great job. And in fact, of all those, I mean, like, what's the best job I've ever had? Yeah, clearly this one at Dateline. But the one I look back most fondly on is political reporter in New York City. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great. And then I left to go to L.A. in 91 to be a political reporter for a station out there. Then I went to a program on Fox that didn't last called Front Page, which none of you probably remember. It was only on for about
like a magazine
8 or 10 months. It was their magazine show. Ron Reagan, the president's son, was one of the other correspondents, very nice guy. Mm-hmm. And that didn't last. And then I sat around for a while kind of figuring out what I was going to do. And then Dateline, which I had already turned down to go to Front Page.
Wait, did you just say you turned down Dateline?
I turned them down. They offered me a job out of KCAL, and I wanted to go to Fox. This was not on the Fox News Channel. It was on the regular Fox Network.
Wait, like, so you're saying you were at KCAL?
I was at KCAL. I was at Channel 9.
And you were at Channel 9 being a reporter.
You were not yet at Channel 11, I don't think, when I was there.
I was at Channel 11. That's the Fox station in Los Angeles. 94 to 96.
Yeah, I was not in local news by then. And you were also like a child.
I was only two.
Right, it was weird. There was a whole labor law thing that we all covered as to how somebody that young could be put on television.
Don't tell my current employer, yeah, which is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
You were totally exploited at the time because, there was no question about that. I mostly knew you, I saw you on the air a lot, but I didn't actually meet you until years later. But
Josh Mankiewicz would say he saw me on the air?
I did. I certainly knew who you were, but I didn't meet you for a few years after that.
That's when I was the fourth bench, I was still coming up.
Mm-hmm. Which is what we all go through. I had turned down Dateline to go to Fox because I thought it'd be fun to do this show for Fox, which was kind of a nutty, different show.
I still can't get over that. So was it a correspondent job at Dateline?
Yep.
And who was on Dateline at the time?
Stone Phillips and Jane Pauley were the anchors.
Wow.
Brian Ross was there. Deborah Roberts was still there before she went to 2020. Keith was not there yet, but Dennis was. Lee Thompson was like a consumer reporter who worked from Washington. I'm forgetting a couple of people, but there were about seven correspondents. And they wanted to make me one of them, and I was like, well, I'm going to take this thing at Fox. Yeah.
Wow.
And then the Fox thing blew up, and Dateline was still hiring. I called them back, and they were like, yeah, okay. Yeah. So that was in 95, and that turned out to be a good thing. And then
That turned out to be a good thing.
And then, I worked there like 12 years. We didn't start doing crime until like 2006, 2007.
Right.
And I didn't want to do it at all when it started.
Talk about that.
When we started, we did like five or six unrelated stories in the hour, and it was kind of like...
It was more like a news hour program.
It was like
a magazine type.
We used to think of ourselves as kind of like the cooler 60 Minutes.
Sure.
The stories were definitely a little more fast-paced, and they were about all kinds of things. I mean, there might be an investigative thing, or it might be a profile. I mean, I did stories about like how to raise your kids, which is amusing since I didn't and don't have any kids. My only experience with kids has been with extremely young people, like Angeline.
They didn't do crime.
We didn't do these hour-long murders. We did a bunch of different shorter stories.
How did the concept come about? They say, well, we'll just do crime for an hour. One story per hour, pretty much.
Like most decisions at Dateline, though, that occurred in a room that I was not in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how they started doing it, I'm not sure. But it was clear that we were heading in that direction. I saw them assigning more and more of this stuff. And I wasn't super interested in it just because I thought, like, the police beat felt like going backwards to me. It felt like going back to local news. And then I did one, which was the murder of Breonna Dennison in Reno. And it went pretty well. And it was a pretty good story. And I suddenly realized, reporting's reporting and writing's writing, and you can tell a
story,
an important, vital story that has every bit as much resonance to people in the audience as a story about some local political issue, some ballot proposition or a Senate campaign, all of which, those other things, they're getting covered to death. I mean, there's no shortage of stories about your local Senate race wherever you live, but there was nothing like this that was examining some big crime or even some crime that you didn't know about in a serious, drawn out way, and I liked it. And then what happened was you liked it, and
you
we
liked
started doing it more, and then we started doing it all the time, and look, I didn't see this coming. I mean, if you'd asked me what was going to happen, 30 years ago, I would have told you I would still be covering politics. But it didn't work out that way, and I'm glad.
So of all, there's so many stories that you've covered.
Yeah.
But people, I get the overwhelming question that I've been getting from people to ask you is, what is the story that either keeps you up at night or has impacted you the most? I know there's got to be more than one.
Well, nothing keeps me up at night because I take a lot of pills.
Do you?
But, yeah.
And how do you wake up in the morning?
Yeah.
Lots of coffee?
Yeah, around noon. Yeah.
Lots of coffee.
But, yeah. What's morning? but, no. Uh, I mean, I talked yesterday about the murder of Steve Pitt, who I knew. And that was really, really, I mean, that was as upsetting as it would be to any of you who had a friend murdered. But I didn't have to do it. I mean, I could have given that story to somebody else, and then maybe I would have been interviewed in the story, but it just didn't feel right. I wanted to do it, so I'm glad I did it. The thing I loved about that story was not that it really had to do with Steve, but the main character in that story was the wife of the killer. She had escaped being killed because she was a physician, still is, and had been able to spend a colossal amount of money to hide herself over the years. And so he couldn't find her. And when he couldn't find her, then he killed Steve, and he went to the law office where the wife's attorney had worked, and the attorney had gone for the day, so he killed a couple of paralegals who happened to be working late. Then he went to the psychiatrist's office who had treated their son, who he saw as having turned the son against him, when in fact it was almost certainly he who had turned his own son against him. And the psychiatrist wasn't there, but some guy who rented an office from the psychiatrist was there, so he killed that guy who didn't have anything to do with any of this. And Steve was at his office, and he got murdered as he walked out to his car. But Connie, the wife of the killer, she had escaped all of this and figured out also who it was when she saw who was being murdered. And so she was being kept safe, and then the guy killed himself. And then we did an interview with her. And this was the first time in my time at Dateline that I had done a story that was essentially all about domestic violence. That's why she left him. That's why all of this originally happened. It's why he was evaluated by Steve. It's why Steve gave him a bad evaluation. That had been 8 years earlier. Now, what made him tip over 8 years later, I don't know. It's been speculated that he believed that after a certain amount of time, he'd be able to have a relationship with his son, and maybe his son said, you know, I'm afraid of you, my mom's afraid of you, stay away from us. I don't know. But something made this guy tip over, and as Steve would say, nothing ever happens in a vacuum like that. Something happened, we might not know what it was. But we got an interview with her, the thing that brought that story home to me was Steve. The thing that was so great about that story was we were able to interview her. And she told the story of what it's like to be in that kind of marriage, and she was very unflinching about it, including all the questions that I'm sure all of you asked when you saw this, which was, why didn't you leave this guy? Which is the first thing out of everybody's mouth. And the answer is, the most dangerous time for any woman in a relationship like that is exactly when you decide to leave. And you can't just, like, you know, most of these guys, they're not going to say, all right then, well,
see you later.
Yeah, I guess we've tried everything. That's the door. Can I give you a lift? You know, that doesn't happen. So she spent a lot of time sort of plotting how she was going to get away from him, because she knew quite correctly that he wasn't going to stop just because she left. She had to leave while he was out of the house. She had to provide for their son, and she had to make sure that they couldn't be found. So she told that story. Frequently, domestic violence is some element to our Dateline stories, but it's usually in the background in some way. And we usually end up focusing more on the actual murder that is happening. And in this case, that was really sort of front and center. I thought it was great to be able to sort of talk about that to the audience and have Connie sort of tell her story, you know, what it's like to be with a guy in a bad marriage who's abusing you, who's terrifying you, who's abusing your child, who threatens to kill you.
Yeah.
And what he threatened was that he was going to kill the child and himself so that she would have to live with the knowledge, but not her, that she would have to live with the knowledge that she'd caused her son's death.
Mm-hmm.
So she quite rightly got out of there, got herself hidden, got the son hidden. They had like three houses. They were moving around all over the Phoenix area. So now the only good news that came out of this is at least I think they're safe because he's gone. So I was really glad to be able to tell that story, not just because it involved a friend of mine, but because it was about domestic violence, which doesn't get enough coverage. And the other story I did in 2005, which was only one segment. It was only about like 8 minutes long on Dateline. It was a story I pitched out of frustration, and David Corvo, our great executive producer, actually read the pitch and said, yeah, we're going to do this. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, when I pitched this, I didn't think you were going to say yes. I was pitching it more because I was like sort of pissed off about the direction we were going. And the story I pitched was that we didn't cover anybody the way we covered white, blonde women. How we'd done all these stories on Natalie Holloway, and we'd done all these stories on other missing young women, all of whom, I mean, if you watched TV back then, around the early part of 2003, 4, 5, you would believe, not just on NBC, everywhere, that the only people missing in this country were young, blonde, attractive women. Lacey Peterson.
Missing white woman syndrome.
And we were as complicit in this as anybody else. So I did a story about this, and I interviewed a couple of people about it, and I found this woman in South Carolina who had been an American Idol contestant. And then she vanished, and nobody, her family couldn't find her, and they were frantic with worry. And her aunt was a PR executive, and she's married to Desmond Howard, now on ESPN, then NFL former Super Bowl MVP with the Packers. And so they had some access to the media, and their family, I think, thought, okay, we're gonna get Tamika's case in front of the public the way all these other cases are, except Tamika was black, and nobody returned their call. Nobody. And it was an identical situation with so many other cases that we covered, except those people weren't black. And so I did that story, I talked to Tamika's family, I talked to a woman who'd written a book about race in the press, and then I invited all the network news division presidents and all the cable news presidents to talk about it. And of course, they all, one by one, turned us down and said they weren't available for interviews. And the only one that said yes was the guy who had hired me at NBC News, Neil Shapiro, who was then the president of NBC News. So I ended up having this like semi-confrontational interview with the guy who had hired me, who's also one of my best friends, and still is to this day. So I guess we survived that. But afterwards, he said to me, that was not pleasant. I'm like, yeah, I know. But he had to, you know, he had to bear the brunt of the criticism for so many, what he and a lot of other people had were responsible for. But after that, I felt the ship of state move a little bit. I mean, it's not like we started covering people we weren't covering before, but we stopped doing the things that we had been doing again and again and again. I mean, I don't know how many. I knew then, I don't know now, how many hours Dateline had done on Natalie Holloway, but it was too many. I mean, it wasn't worth 7 of them or whatever it was. It was a huge number. So there were other people that weren't getting coverage.
Amazing that you did that, really.
Yeah, so that was, well, what amazed me was that David, like, looked at the pitch and said, hey, yeah, we're going to do this story. And then he did it, and he put it on television.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was the thing that was great about that.
I mean, even today, that's, Listen, I know we could talk about just that subject alone for hours.
Right, but we're going to talk about some more important things now.
We want to know if you like thin crust or thick crust.
Thick. Chicago. Yeah. If I lived in Chicago, I would physically not be able to get out one of these two doors. I'd be imprisoned in this room. Yeah.
We want to know Taylor Swift or Katy Perry?
Well, I went to a wedding that was in the fall of 2015, and there were all these big shots at the wedding. Katy Perry was there, and she was still with John Mayer, I think, and they both sang separately. And every morning at this wedding, which lasted, you know, like 4 or 5 days in this property that people had taken over, first of all, we're all, you know, my then girlfriend, now wife, and I were looking at all these people. Like, I know who that is. Who that is, right? We were quite like, whew. And so every morning at this thing, this big, they were living in this big compound out in the woods, very exclusive place in Wyoming. And every morning you saw all these people, you know, just get up and go to breakfast, looking like all of us do, right? I mean, you know, I saw, you know, John Mayer, and, you know, his hair looks like origami in the morning, you know. And we're all, you know, we're all sitting there like eating, right? Seth
Meyers. And everybody says, I want a selfie,
No, right there now. They laid down the law that there was to be none of that, so I have no pictures. Bruce Springsteen picked up his guitar in front of me and started playing. I was like afraid to move, yeah. You know. Tom Hanks presided at this wedding. He was really good. And Rita, big Dateline fan, it turns out. And everybody looks like you would expect them to look at, you know, 8 in the morning for breakfast, except Katy Perry, who was like camera ready at all times of the day and
gotta
night.
Be, gotta
I
be.
Could not. I remember thinking to myself, no, I mean, there was this law.
She wakes up like that.
There, yeah. Apparently, mm-hmm. But there was this law, like they made very clear, like, do not take any pictures and do not post anything. So I didn't. I don't think anybody did. We all abided by the rules. But she was like ready. She was ready at all times. But Taylor Swift is like the world's biggest Dateline fan. So,
yes, she is.
Gotta pick her.
Okay. We could talk for hours, Josh, but I know you've got to.
I gotta go get on an airplane, which is where Keith and Dennis and everybody else already are. I only stayed because, you know, Angeline, is the greatest. Now this, you know, this is some of the most important work of anybody here at CrimeCon is the work done by Angelina and the people she works with. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Well, you're the greatest.
Thank you, Josh.
And that's it for this bonus episode of Inside Crime. I want to let you know that this year's CrimeCon will be a very cool virtual event called House Arrest. It happens November 21st, and Inside Crime will be a part of it. You can go to crimecon.com for more info. Be sure to use our Inside Crime promo code to get a 10% discount. It's promo code INSIDE2020. That's INSIDE2020. I hope to see you there.